Our scripture reading this evening is taken from the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 6. Ecclesiastes, chapter 6. Solomon's great point in Ecclesiastes to do with the meaning of life. You've noted that the one possible motto, if you will, for the book is there a meaning in this life? Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. That is, all under the sun is passing away. So, Ecclesiastes chapter 6. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honour, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires, yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it is an evil affliction. If a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say the stillborn child is better than he. For it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place. All the labour of man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. For what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Whatever one is, he has been named already. For it is known that he is man, and he cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. Since there are many things to increase vanity, how is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in life? All the days of his vain life which he passes like a shadow, who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? And may God bless the reading of his holy word. Solomon has observed that in the previous chapter, Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 18 and 19, here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labour in which he toils under the sun, all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. And every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labour, this is the gift of God. And then verse 20, for he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. That is that Solomon says that part of the secret, if you will, to the good life is enjoying life as God's good gift. But what happens when you have a situation where people are not able to enjoy life? In other words, the problem of people being unfulfilled, unsatisfied. And so chapter 6 begins with this question. There is an evil which I've seen under the sun, and it is that evil of people who have everything and yet enjoy nothing. The man who has everything and enjoys absolutely nothing. And so verse 2, we have this picture, a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honour so that he lacks nothing for himself of all that he desires. He has everything. And yet God does not give him power to eat of it. Now, of course, eat here is at least partially a metaphor, because you cannot eat wealth and honour. Suppose you could in the days of Abraham, when a man's wealth was counted in his camels and his flocks, but certainly by the time of Solomon, wealth is very largely counted in terms of gold, silver and precious things. And of course one cannot eat honour. But the picture there, and again it's a very Hebrew way of doing things, this very concrete image of somebody eating. How do you enjoy life? Well, here is a man who is a consumer, in the sense that all these things, what you eat sustains you, what you eat satisfies you. And here is a man who has everything, and yet he cannot satisfy himself with any of it. God does not give him power to eat of it. but a foreigner consumes it. It's all for somebody else. It's all for other people. The wealthy man loses his wealth in a moment. The foreign invasion, or perhaps he goes bust and he's bought out by a foreign competitor. This is vanity and it is an evil affliction. This is the passing nature of life. So the word vanity is this Hebrew word hevel, which means breath. The exhalation on a chilly morning, and you see the breath, the condensation of the air, and then it is gone. This is vanity and evil affliction. And again, he uses another picture here, a man who has 100 children. There's a certain, shall we say, hyperbole here. Although someone like Solomon, who had so many wives, it's likely he would have had an awful lot of children. In those days when rich men very commonly were polygamists, they might have many, many children. I've got a book at home on Mormon polygamy. It's got this photograph on the front with this man and all his wives and all these children. You think, golly, how miserable they all look. But the man has 100 children and lives many years. And indeed, verse 6, you have the picture. If he lives twice, if he lives 1,000 years twice. Methuselah didn't quite get to 1,000. Imagine a man, Sir Solomon, who has a lifespan twice the length of Methuselah, who has this enormously long lifespan, and he has 100 children. But his soul is not satisfied with goodness. He doesn't enjoy anything. His life is not a matter of enjoyment. There's no enjoyment, and he has no burial. Now, having no burial here is a picture of nobody cares about him when he dies. There's nobody to honour him or care about him when he dies. And Solomon uses this striking image here. I say a stillborn child is better than he. If a man should live 2,000 years and yet have no rest and yet have no satisfaction, nothing but toil and trouble for 2,000 years, he says it's better that he should never have lived at all in the world. For it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and his name is covered with darkness. In those days, sadly, stillborn children were not uncommon. And quite often you'd have a situation where a family name would be recycled through. One sees this sometimes in old monuments and churches. You see, you've got a family, and there's a list. And of course, the monuments on the walls, they're the important families. There's a list of children died in infancy, and you'll find perhaps John died in infancy. John died in infancy. John died in infancy. The name is just forgotten, it's passed on. And though it has not seen the sun or known anything, it has more rest than that man. No rest for 2,000 years, and the stillborn child goes straight into rest. Solomon, of course, says little. The Bible says very little in terms of the destiny of those who die in infancy. But one thing we know: will not the judge of all the earth do right? King David, when he contemplates his child, Solomon's older brother, who died in infancy, not long after being born, he says of his son, I will go to him, but he will not return to me. Solomon, after all, would have been told about that older brother, that brother who died in infancy. And it's very possible that that thought is behind this. My older brother, wherever he is, he has gone to rest. He is resting with God. But this man, this hypothetical man who lives 2,000 years with no rest, with no ultimate honour, with no satisfaction, far better not to have lived at all than to have lived a long and miserable life. And when we say a miserable life, it's not talking in terms of a life where there's hardship, but a life where there is no enjoyment, a life where somebody is labouring and labouring and labouring, and whatever they accomplish, whatever they gain, they lose. The story is told of a certain wealthy man in the 19th century who decided he would make for himself a great art collection. And so he sent to Italy, he sent to France, sent all over the continent looking for the most beautiful artworks to adorn his house. And then he went blind. And all that effort to find these pictures, and he could see none of them. All this effort, and he never had the power to enjoy. And that's the picture here. A man to whom God has given stuff, but not the power to enjoy it, because life is more than stuff. Life is more than things. We are indeed, as God speaks to Adam in Genesis chapter 3, speaking of the curse in verse 19. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. This world is passing away and all that it desires. But he who does the will of God abides forever. If all a man has is trouble, then indeed his life ultimately is not worth it. But what's the answer? Solomon, unlike some of the commentators, imagine that Solomon is just here being incredibly cynical and life isn't worth it. No, the point is that life is worth it, but that life that is worth it is life with God. And so, verse 7, all the labour of man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. And this is probably an existing proverb that Solomon has picked up and incorporated into his work here. A proverb about the reality of humanity, that we are more than things, we are more than stuff. And we are more than mouths. A man is more than a mouth. All the labour of man is for his mouth. People, again, remembering the setting here, this is the ancient Near East, this is a situation where most people are what we call subsistence farmers. That is, they grow enough for themselves and their family, and a little bit more to sell on in the market. But most of what people are doing, they are labouring to feed themselves. It's the exceptional people, the traders, the wealthy farmers, the gentry, the people who employ servants. They are the exception, who are labouring for more than just enough to satisfy. But if all the labour of man is for his mouth, yet the soul is not satisfied. Man is more than a mouth. We have a soul. God has put, as Solomon has already said in Ecclesiastes, that God has put eternity in their hearts. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11. He has put eternity in their hearts. There is that in man that looks for more. God, when he made human beings, he made us both physical and spiritual. There is the body and there is the soul, and the two are united. And food will satisfy the body, but it will never satisfy the soul. The whole of man, we were made for more. We were made for God. And so he goes on, what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Now, some commentators will suggest that the answer that Solomon is looking for here is nothing. That seems highly unlikely. Now, the whole point when Solomon speaks about the contrast of the wise and the fool is that the wise has something more than the fool. So what is it that makes the wise man better than the fool? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Solomon's expecting the reader to go, yes, this is what the wise man has more than the fool. This is the answer. God himself is the answer to the question, how do we have meaning and rest and satisfaction in life? We are, with that great quotation, that great words of Augustine of Hippo in his Confessions, Lord, thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in thee. And the problem with the fool is the fool has said in his heart there is no God. The fool has said there is nothing that I can find satisfaction in beyond the world. And so the fool spends his time trying to find satisfaction in the world, in stuff, in his work. Now it's, I think in some ways, sad to look at the prospects of the next American presidential election. We have Joe Biden in his 80s looking to be re-elected. Why is a man in his 80s looking to be re-elected President of the United States? It's a very difficult job. I suspect the answer is that Biden finds the meaning of his life in politics. And that's very sad. Now, the longest-lived US senator, quite a startling statistic. Do you know how old he was when he died? A man called Strom Thurmond from the American South. He was 100 years old, and he was still in the Senate at 100. His whole life was wrapped up in politics. That was the whole meaning of his life. You see this sometimes with people who retire from their work, and they die not long afterwards, because their work was their whole life. What more has the wise man than the fool? The wise man has more because the wise man knows that satisfaction in life is not found in our work, in our possessions, in our pleasures, but satisfaction is found in God. The wise man knows and acknowledges that there is a God. The fool says in his heart there is no God, and so he chases after satisfaction in all the wrong places. What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Well, the poor man who knows how, in other words, who knows how to live, again, has wisdom. He has that wisdom that begins with the fear of the Lord. And so the wise man finds himself, like as verse 9 says, better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. Or as we say in English, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. That is, the possession of the thing is better than the prospect of something greater. Better to have, as Solomon says elsewhere, one handful with peace than two handfuls with strife. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. Because again, Solomon's point here is, back in verse 18, he says, it is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labour in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. In other words, enjoy what you have now. We are not always, again the fool does it, the eyes of the fool are in the ends of the earth. The fool is always looking to the future. He's always looking to something that is yet to be. He's not looking at the present. He's not enjoying the present as God's gift, again, because he is a fool, and looking for satisfaction in everything other than God. The wandering of desire is vanity and grasping for the wind. It will never be satisfied. For we are creatures. We have our limitations. Verse 10 is about this great limitation that we have. But not just limitation, but about the Lord. Whatever one is, he has been named already. That is to say that God has made everything and God has defined everything. We see people not just pushing at the boundaries of human ability, but trying to go beyond it. There's a whole movement of people who call themselves transhumanists, who want to make humanity different. These sort of people who talk about creating cyborgs and genetic engineering and making people sort of supermen. All of this is forgetting the fact that it is God who has made us. It is he who has made us and not we ourselves, the psalmist says in the 100th Psalm. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. It is he who has made us. It is known that he is man. God has given us a name. He has given humanity a name. That name is Adam. That name is Adam. From the red earth, from the dust that God made man. Dust you are, and to dust you shall return. In other words, we have our created creaturely limitations, and they come from God. And he cannot contend with him who is mightier than he, that is with God. But the transhumanists have their argument with the Creator. They wish to tamper with creation. They wish to improve upon creation. I didn't talk about efforts to deal with diseases, to deal even with genetic diseases, because disease is something going wrong with the creation. No, this is transhumanism in the sense of trying to improve upon the creation. He cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. We cannot contend with God. We cannot win if we fight against God. If we fight the Lord, then the Lord will win. So it is. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? How is man the better for all these things that people try to do? All these efforts to not cure diseases, but try to make man more than man is. We have at the moment these great efforts to extend the human lifespan. And more than once, somebody say to me, well, I'm not sure I like this idea. And it's one thing if you've got somebody who is naturally very long-lived. I think the late Duke of Edinburgh, for example, who he went to 100. Strom Thurmond's another example, a man who got to 100. And these were men who were naturally long-lived. It's a man who... But when you've got this effort just to try to stretch a few more years, a few more years, a few more years, how is man the better? How are things the better? Because at the other end of the scale, of course, you've got this concern now, this idea now of so-called euthanasia, which is a terrible business, this idea of that people are to be made to feel guilty if they're living longer. And of course, all the slippery slope arguments, oh, it's just a slippery slope argument, turns out actually the slope is slippery. That it goes from people with terminal diseases being encouraged to save the state some money, or to save the hospitals some time and effort, goes to, well, if you just feel you're too old and miserable, you should end it. No. It's in the Lord's hands. Life and death is in God's hands. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? How is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in life? All the days of his vain life, his passing life, which he passes like a shadow. Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? Well, we should be screaming at this point. God can. God knows. God can. God knows what is good for man in life. And what fools we are when we think that we know better. When we think that we can make a better world without reference to God. We've been trying for so long. And we have failed. We have failed. The United Nations has very largely failed, just as the League of Nations failed. Every effort to make human life better, well, it may increase life expectancy? Does it increase joy and happiness among man? We see all these troubles with drugs, all these concerns over consumption. Who knows what is good for man in life? God knows what is good for man in life. If we think we know better than God, if we think that we can have the good life without reference to God, what fools we are. Because this is a passing world. This world is passing away and all that it desires. This world, and our lives, they're what? Our life passes like a shadow. We find, for example, King David, Solomon's father, no doubt words that Solomon's remembering here, 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 15. For we are but aliens and pilgrims before you, as were all our fathers. Our days on earth are as a shadow, and without hope, on earth under the sun. David here sounds so much like Solomon in Ecclesiastes. Or again, Psalm 102, and verse 11, Psalm 102, and verse 11, the prayer of the afflicted. My days are like a shadow that lengthens, and I wither away like grass, but you, O Lord, shall endure forever, and the remembrance of your name to all generations. You will arise and have mercy on Zion. It is God, and God alone, who knows what is good for us in our passing lives, to live under him, to do indeed as King David, who served his own generation by the will of God and fell asleep. God knows what is good for man. The life of fellowship, this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. Who knows? Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? Again, God alone. God knows the end from the beginning. We cannot see the future, for which we are very thankful. There is this mania, of course, among human beings, and it goes back into ancient times, to try to know what the future will be. The soothsayers and the prognosticators, the astrologers, the people who study the entrails of animals and the tea leaves in a cup. And all of them, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. It's all a delusion, this idea that we can somehow know the future. God knows the future. And we can leave it then in his hands. Those who are indeed wise, who have the fear of God that is the beginning of wisdom, then we can rest knowing that we don't know the future, we don't know what's going to happen, but God knows perfectly all that is to happen. After all, James says, James chapter 4 verse 14, we'll read from verse 13, come now you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapour that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. But God knows. God holds our future. God holds the key of all unknown, as Dr. Parker put it, and I am glad. So it is for the wise man. The wise man can answer the question, who knows? Who can tell? God knows. God can tell. And all things are in his hands. And therefore, we can enjoy God's good gifts. God gives us richly all things to enjoy. To enjoy, not to abuse, not to misuse, but to enjoy. He gives us the days, sufficient to the days, the evil thereof. And he gives us the days one by one, that in those days we may enjoy all things in him and from him, that we may spend our days in fellowship. Indeed, again, to quote Augustine, Lord, thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in thee. Oh, may we find our rest day by day in our God. Amen.